Scientists have started a flu pandemic in a city the size of Chicago, about 8 million people. They wanted to know if its spread could be slowed even without a flu vaccine available. Not to worry. Don't worry, those folks in Chicago. This was not a real flu outbreak, but a virtual flu, a computer simulation in a virtual city. It allowed the researchers to try out different strategies for fighting the flu to keep it in check and prevent a pandemic like that really tragic 1918 flu. And they reported the results in this week's issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Joining us now to talk about the study is one of its authors, Betts Halloran. Dr. Halloran is professor of biostatistics at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and University of Washington in Seattle. She joins us today from her office there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Halloran.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Give us a scenario. You put a scenario into the computer. Tell us what that was.
Well, we put a scenario of a combination of interventions into the computer, and the least stringent one, that is our base case, it consisted of finding about 60% of the symptomatic influenza cases, treating those cases we found with Tamiflu, as well as giving Tamiflu to the other members of their household to prevent flu. The cases and the other household members were requested to stay home. That is also known as isolation of cases and quarantine of exposed contacts. But in our simulation, only about 60% of the cases and 30% of the contacts actually stayed home. Then we also closed the schools, but only about 30% of the children actually stayed at home instead of mixing in the community. And then we further assumed that contacts in the workplace and in the community at large were cut in half. That was our base case scenario.
So you had you told people to stay home from school?
Yes,
you told them
the schools. The schools were actually completely closed.
Schools were closed. What did you tell people to do about working?
Well, at work, we told them to try to reduce their contacts. Of course, this is a simulated population,
right.
So what we tell them is how we program them. So what we did was reduce the number of contacts that they were having in the workplace. This might be achieved by staggering people going to work, having people work from home. How it would actually happen in reality is something that public health professionals need to think about.
Mm-hmm. And you did not have a vaccine to give them, right?
Not in these scenarios, no. We have done other studies, and I'm happy to talk about that. But in this particular study, because the vaccines are now just coming down the pike, the public health professionals up at in Washington were interested in looking at scenarios where no vaccine was available.
Mm-hmm. And usually it would take, in real life, it would take, what, 6 months to develop one?
Yes. Under current technologies, people feel that to develop a well-matched vaccine would take about 6 months. However, a lot of the flu vaccine companies are working on what we call pre-pandemic vaccines, which are being developed in response to the bird flu so that they would be hopefully enough well-matched, if it were a bird flu type that got into humans, that they would offer some protection.
Mm-hmm. So you found that if people stayed away from one another, how much could you slow down the pandemic or the spread of the flu?
Well, by the scenario I just gave you, and we had about 8.6 million people in our Chicago-like population living in families and going to schools and daycare centers and workplaces, then if without an intervention, at about 4 million of the 8.6 million people would have developed symptomatic influenza within about 6 months. But with the intervention I just described, the numbers reduced to between about a quarter and a half million. That is quite a reduction. And this is with concerted social distancing and, to a lesser extent, the case finding. So the simulations do suggest that a pandemic could be slowed and the number of cases reduced until a well-matched vaccine were available if we were able to achieve this amount of social distancing.
Mm-hmm. So how do you consider the results of this simulation? Successful? Is there a way that you would call it successful? Just a learning experience?
Well, we developed these particular scenarios in conjunction with Richard Hatchett and Rajiv Venkaya, who were advisors to the White House Homeland Security Council. And so we hope now that these have been published, that public health professionals at the local and county and city level can think about how they might actually implement some of these things. Of course, it's easy in the computer to implement these things, but whether we can actually implement these things in our own society is quite another matter.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk about the flu. Let's see if we have a call already. Let's go to Judith in Chico, California. Hi, Judith.
Yes. The thing that always astounded me about the 1918 epidemic, and there seems to be little connection made when it's discussed, it was during the First World War. Soldiers were dying on the transport ships, in the camps and things. The government, the U.S. government, was holding huge bond drives with parades and congregations of people. So it seemed it was inevitable that you'd have this wildfire spread. Mm. So the idea of keeping people separate from other people seems to make more sense than anything.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And there is some evidence from cities during the pandemic at that time. The cities that instigated early social distancing measures
had much lower death rate.
I completely agree with your comment.
Thank you, Judith.
You're welcome.
1-800-989-8255. But doesn't this seem like it's common sense? If you don't want to spread the flu, stay at home.
That's exactly right, Ira. I mean, that is common sense. This is standard operating procedure for any infectious disease to isolate the people who are infectious and people don't go out and expose themselves. So it's there can be some social cost, of course, and that's what we have to look at. But this is the standard way of trying to reduce spread of any infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
So we were looking at this at what the potential might be, and by how much we might be able to reduce it.
How long would you have to quarantine infected households?
We kept the people at home until the case was well again. Usually took a couple of weeks
to
get better.
Did you change variables and come up with different scenarios?
Yes, we did change variables, if you want to hear about
that. Sure.
We looked at different levels of transmissibility of the virus. Now, in this particular research, we looked at different levels of how many cases one case would produce. That's also called the basic reproductive number. But the base case scenario I just described to you is where one case produces about two other cases.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's actually considered by most people as pretty high for a pandemic flu, because the virus, if it comes, say, from the birds, will not be well adapted to the human population, and probably the number of cases that one case will produce will be much lower. So what I described to you was already a pretty bad case scenario. But we actually looked at higher case scenarios because the government was interested in hearing really worst-case scenarios. So we have scenarios where then more like 60% of the people get infected instead of just about 40%.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at those. And at that level, of course, the interventions don't do quite as well. But that's really the worst-case scenario. I mean, we aren't really expecting that.
Mm-hmm.
We varied the level of workplace social distancing, you know, between 0 and 50%. We varied different thresholds of when we closed the schools. We varied different levels of compliance. We looked at all sorts of things, and I described the base case, which I think is probably as much as we'd ever be able to achieve.
Right. And how many people did you think you saved by making that scenario?
Saved in what sense?
Saved from death.
Well, substantial. And, of course, I didn't report death because the mortality is not well known. The mortality of the pandemic in 1918 was something like 2 in 100. 2 in 100 of the people who actually got flu died, whereas there were pandemics in 1957 and 1968. And in those pandemics, only about 2 in 10,000 cases died. So that's a factor of 100 difference. So the number of people we actually save from death is going to depend on how lethal the virus actually is. So in the worst case scenario, like if we were looking at pandemic like 1918, we might have had, without the intervention, 80,000 deaths in those 6 months in the 8.6 million population in Chicago. And that could be reduced by the scenario described to 10,000. So it's about a factor of 8, which is quite good.
Let's talk to Daryl.
And saving 70,000 deaths in that case, which is substantial.
Wow. Let's talk to Daryl in Phoenix. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate this show so much. I have a question. Those of us that live in communities that don't support infrastructure well, what do we do on our own? Do we make sure we get flu shots every year? I'm 60. I don't usually do it because I'm healthy. What is best?
Well, getting a flu shot every year is recommended, and I would suggest that you do that. That probably wouldn't protect you against a pandemic strain, but that's a good thing to do. And I think at a local level, the results of these studies really need to be considered at the local level and to think in a community and with the public health people in your community, what would you want to do? I mean, this can't just come from a national government. This has to be planned locally.
You have to spend money. You have to spend money locally on this to set up a response to it, would you not?
I'm sorry.
You'd have to spend money locally to develop a response plan.
Right. The response plans need to be developed locally. And I know that a lot of different communities, I don't know all of them, I know some of the communities are thinking about this, and hopefully this will help them think about it more. Because how to implement these things is not something that we suggest through our computer simulation.
You're just doing the facts, ma'am, just the facts.
I'm just the facts. I have the easy job.
let's ask about a harder job from Bruce in Howard City, Michigan. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Thank you for the wonderful show. And
you're
I
welcome.
Just had a question. I was wondering in your computer simulations, if you address isolation and quarantine and the political and financial upheaval that would result with a quarantine on different groups of people in different areas of the country.
Let me just jump in and say this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Dr. Beth Halloran. Yes, were those plugged in, or you just
We did in this particular study. We didn't look at any. We did have isolation and quarantine in the sense we suggested that we didn't have like isolation centers or quarantine centers. We had asked people if they were a case. I mean, if they were a case, they'd probably be sick and want to stay home anyway. But we also asked the people in their household to stay home. But in the simulation I just described, the base case, only 30% of the people complied. There wasn't any forced staying at home. So those are things that have to be considered, and there is a social cost.
Could you plug those in? Could you say, what if the police declared emergency or something and said everybody should stay in their homes? Or were forced to stay in their homes?
Yes, there is actually a study that's been submitted that we're part of that talks about those things and some of the social cost, the cost benefit of doing different interventions and how much the social cost would be. That's not really my specialty. I'm more of a scientist than a public health economist, if you know what I mean. But one can look at those things. And, of course, what is true and what we say that as I mentioned, we don't know how lethal a virus would be in a pandemic. And if it were something like a milder virus, like in the 1957-1968 pandemics, one might decide that it's not lethal enough to have the social cost of closing the schools. In that sense, we say you have to be flexible because depending on exactly what the virus is like, you might decide not to slow down the workplaces, or you might not decide to close the schools because the social cost won't be worth it because it's not really a very lethal virus.
Yeah.
You see what I mean.
I see what you mean.
There's a lot of uncertainty.
It's a trade-off here.
There's a big trade-off, yes.
Where do we stand in developing a vaccine now for the pandemic that we're all expecting to happen someday?
Well, there are several companies around the world that are very close, and there is a vaccine available, at least one from GlaxoSmithKline in Europe, and they have pledged 50 million doses to the WHO to be used as a mobile stockpile if there was an outbreak, say, in Southeast Asia or any place. And there are many other companies that are very close. They have candidates in the late stage of testing. So we should have 6 or 7 candidates available very soon. So, and we have shown in other simulations, in other papers, that if you were able to vaccinate, even with a poorly matched vaccine that had practically only about 30% efficacy, that it would make a big difference in slowing the pandemic. It would really help until one was able to create a well-matched vaccine. So that stockpiling vaccines for pre-pandemic should be a high priority.
But your study shows you can make a big dent until then.
Right.
If people stay home and don't go to school and limit their interaction as much as they can.
Right. But as the one caller pointed out, they have social costs. So if there's a pre-pandemic vaccine available, that would also it would not have the same social cost if we were able to administer that. Even if it were poorly matched, it would really help to reduce the number of cases until you had a well-matched vaccine. So there are pre-pandemic vaccines and then sort of the post-pandemic vaccines. So even though it's not in this paper, having a pre-pandemic vaccine available is a high priority.
Having enough doses available.
And having enough doses available, yes. And that's it's a big commitment, and there's a lot of discussion about it, because if you stockpile vaccines and you buy them all, one isn't sure how long they'll last. And so this is all being discussed at the top levels of the government.
Sure, and then you need to decide who gets the vaccine first.
Right. And we have simulations showing that if you vaccinate about 70%, that could have a substantial effect. However, the politically correct answer is to say you need enough doses to vaccinate everybody, because you wouldn't want to have to choose who got it or not. So, but 70% from a scientific point of view would do a lot of good.
Is that a practical?
70% from a practical point of view would be enough to really probably keep the virus from spreading. However, the government would have a hard time saying which 70% should get it. So one would probably have to have enough doses for everybody.
And there you have it.
And there you have it.
All right, Dr. Halloran, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Well, thank you, Ira, for the opportunity to talk to you.
You're welcome. Beth Halloran is professor of biostatistics at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center at the University of Washington, Seattle. We're going to take a break and come back and celebrate Pi Day. Today is 314. And we'll find out how much you know just what the word pi means. We went out on the streets of New York. We'll be back with our results. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.